corporate prayer. God be with you. God of all creation, we give you thanks for this spring day, for the buds and the flowers, for the sunshine, and for this chance to be together and to explore some of the witnesses to you and to your beautiful story. May you reveal yourselves to us more each day, that we may be aware of your holy presence. In your holy name we pray. Amen. I'm first going to start with the caveat that I am an art enjoyer, not an art expert. So I love art, I love learning about art, but there are certainly people who are more expert in this area than I am, so I'm relying on some of those experts in sharing this information with you. But I did a bit of a deep dive, sort of a rabbit hole, into art in the Celtic tradition. So I'll talk about, the rabbit hole. It's visually there. I'll talk a bit about some Celtic symbols, many of which you've probably seen before, but maybe we'll dig a little deeper into what they mean. And then we'll look at some illuminated manuscripts, which is one of the things the Celtic tradition is really famous for. So let's start with those Celtic symbols. The Celtic knots, we're familiar with these Celtic knots, a particularly well-known piece of the Celtic tradition. In general, these knots point to the way that everything in the world is linked together. We are all linked to one another. Creation is interwoven. God is in all of that. So that's the general theme as it relates to Celtic knots. But each of the knots has its own specificity. The Trinity knot, which did not originally refer to the Trinity in Christian theology, though that is often how we understand it today. It has three loops, and before gaining its association with the Holy Trinity of Christian tradition, people would talk about some of the other threes that we experience in nature. So it might be life, death, and rebirth, or the earth, sea, and sky. Again, with that theme of unity and interconnectedness between those three aspects. So the way that life is linked to death, which is linked to rebirth, and again to life. And those elements of creation, likewise, sharing that interconnectivity and unity. And then it worked really nicely, of course, that we are a Trinitarian tradition. So when Celtic spirituality and Christianity found some meeting points, that Trinity knot became a really helpful illustration and icon of sorts. The next one is the Dara knot, which comes from the Irish word dwar. I have no idea if that is the correct pronunciation. It's spelled D-O-I-R-E, if you're curious. And that word means oak, the oak tree. So this Dara knot is inspired by the intricate root systems of an oak tree. And it symbolizes strength, wisdom, and endurance. Things that are often associated with oaks are shown in that knot. And this is a knot that was often used on doors to a house, just as a reminder of those pieces of wisdom and strength and endurance as it related to family life, to life at home. The love knot is two interconnected hearts, as you can see, and it has no identifiable beginning or end. So the ways it refers to the ways that love is eternal, and that there is a commitment in sharing love, not necessarily just romantic love, love of all sorts. And there's variations on this knot. Some of them are more deeply rooted in the Celtic tradition. Some of them are more modern additions to that tradition. But there are love knots that refer to specific relationships within a family or within a community. But this is a more general depiction. The sailor's knot, I find this one really interesting. I wasn't particularly aware of this one before. But it's intended to be two ropes that are woven together, which once that was pointed out to me makes perfect sense. So two intertwining ropes, and it symbolizes the love and friendship and the strong bonds that happen by going on long sea voyages together. So especially in a time when these groups of people would have been responsible for everything that was happening on a boat, sailboats, or needing to row to get wherever they were going. There was a lot of teamwork in that, a lot of relationship building. So this sailor's knot depicts those relationships. And then there's the spiral knot, or triskel, which is three legs. And this is a single line that splits into three different spirals. And again, this is something that it works nicely for us in a Trinitarian tradition, but it is far before Christianity had any interaction with the Celts, and even before it became a Celtic symbol. So there are instances of this spiral knot being seen as early as 3200 BC. So this is an old image that speaks about creation in the same way that the Trinity knot does, looking at life, death, and rebirth, again, or earth, fire, and water, also associated with this knot. But it's interesting that the spiral knot can be seen in multiple traditions, not just in the Celtic one. There's, of course, Celtic crosses, which when we look closely at many Celtic crosses, they share the tradition of the Celtic knot and use that knot as a way of ornamenting the cross. There's some evidence that there were Celtic crosses before the Celts had interaction with the Christian tradition. And in that sense, it probably was one of these that has more equal sides and might have referred to the cardinal directions, or referred to the elements of earth, water, fire, and air. So interesting, again, that there are some of these images in the Celtic tradition that were pre-Christian, but Christianity maps really nicely or shares really nicely in those images. And originally, these would have been small wooden or metal crosses. I know for me, when I think of a Celtic cross, I'm often thinking of these large stone crosses that have become sort of famous images for this part of the world. But before that, they would have been small, detailed pieces that folks would have kept with them as a pendant or kept in their homes. So they started as much smaller pieces than how we often see them today. I've included Brigid's cross in part because I really love Brigid. She was at the Abbey in Kildare, and her lineage and her patronage is often overlapped with that of Patrick. But she has this beautiful cross that is, it's more recent than these other Celtic symbols that we're looking at, but a cross that's made of reeds or straw, and is intended to protect homes from evil, danger, and disease. And when it's woven together, it creates this sort of diamond shape in the center. And because it's made with natural materials, it's nearly impossible to get the lines in the center perfectly parallel to one another. And that emphasizes the beauty and uniqueness of creation. It doesn't need to be perfect and doesn't need those exact parallels to be a witness to God and to offer that protection. So I just appreciate that celebration of the natural world in that way. The tree of life is another common Celtic symbol. And has some symbols within the symbol, too. So again, we see the knots that are at the roots of the tree. This particular depiction has a heart down at the bottom as well. So these large symmetrical trees, as you can see, they bend around in a circular shape. And these trees are meant to symbolize strength, wisdom, and longevity. And the circle emphasizes the connection between earth, heaven, and the underworld. So again, leaning into these aspects of creation and a pre-Christian spirituality. The circle can also reflect the circle of life, representing harmony and balance in nature, and can also speak to connections across generations. The connections across generations was a piece of this symbolism that I wasn't aware of previously, but it makes good sense the way that it comes back around. In Celtic practice, when Celts planted a new community, they would literally plant a tree at the center of that community. It was called the Tree of Life. So this is a symbol that they used, but also a practice that they used as they were developing new communities. So it's interesting to see the interplay of spiritual practice, community practice, and the images that come along with it. Say more. Can you point them out?
Heart in the center.
Uh-huh.
And then directly on either side of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So these down here.
Such a cool image.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one that when you first look at it, it seems sort of simple, but we could easily spend plenty of time just looking at the details of it.
Yeah.
Any comments, questions, or thoughts on those images that we've looked at so far? These Celtic symbols?
Going back to the first group.
Mm-hmm.
The spirit, the spiral?
Yes.
When I was in Ireland, I noticed a snail that has that image on its back.
Oh.
It's not the triune, it's just one
sure.
spiral.
Right. Right, and I wonder about a connection between those. Because the Celts were looking so much at the natural world, there are places that we can find that spiral in the natural world. So I would think that there's a connection there, just based on what I know of their spirituality. That's really cool.
And I had no idea that some of these preceded Christian, imagery. So with the Dara knot, mm-hmm. am I projecting the cross kind of in the center, or is it, yeah?
Yeah, we see a cross. They may or may not have. But again, these Celtic crosses, some of them predated Christianity too. So there's other ways that these four points made sense in imagery. But it works really nicely for us that we can see that cross in the images. So that wouldn't have been the explicit intention at the start of the use of the symbol.
Thank you. The other thing I noticed at the beginning were two rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
And then so far we've had mostly butterflies on the other slides. And I wondered if there was anything about the two rabbits and...
I just thought it looked cute. That's the real answer. So I normally make my slide presentations in a software called Canva, and I looked up earthy Christianity, and it got these slide templates. So not any real significance.
I was married in Ireland, so I probably should know.
I mean, we could meditate on that and find plenty. Butterflies often associated with Easter. Yeah.
When I think about Celtic art, and especially in the context of pre-Christian times, and I think this is everywhere, but in this context, it's art, but I don't get the sense that for much of the time, even after Christians arrived in the area, that there was an artistic class. Like we have these artists, you know, like, oh, you know, we have farmers, we have traders, and then we have these artists who devote their lives, and we have galleries and collections and such. Do you have any sense of the sort of the form of these knots and such? And I usually see them as something on a flat surface, like on paper, like drawn knots.
Right.
Would they be metal or wooden? Would they be kind of homemade kind of folk art, or would they be the result of some craftsman who?
I think there's a variety. So there definitely were, these images can be found in wood, metal, and stone. The wood likely would have been folk art that an individual could set out to carve. The stone, of course, would take more labor and more expertise. So I think it depends, but part of them being used as spiritual symbols more so than like fine art in the way that we think about it now is that the emphasis isn't on the perfection of it. So the folk art aspect is an important part of the practice. Yeah.
I'm struck by the value of space.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, there's the part that's drawn, the part that is positively present, but the beauty of these symbols depends in large part on the absence of something, on the presence of space, of boundary, of distance, if you will. And I think, I don't know, like that's in a lot of relationships and in our spiritual practice, the not just speaking, but also being silent, leaving room.
Yeah, I like that. And that's something that comes up around the Celtic crosses too. Some people will say that each of the lines refers to the cardinal directions, like a compass, but that the negative space that's created by that circle becomes pockets for the elements. So, I mean, it speaks to what you're saying, that there's, in that negative space, or in the space that is without, something is there. Yeah. We'll shift into illuminated manuscripts, which are a lot of fun. This is a place where I could have easily gotten into this for hours and hours, just looking at some of these manuscripts. So part of monastic life included making these manuscripts, particularly among those abbeys that were in Ireland and Scotland. This is part of the tradition for them. So there's an area in the abbey that would be called the scriptorium, which literally means the place of writing, which we can hear in that word, scriptorium. And in abbeys that had a scriptorium, there would have been a division of labor, and this still would have been a specialized skill within monastic life. So it wouldn't have been all of the monks who were part of this. But the ones who were, each had a specific job related to creating these manuscripts. Some of them were what we would really think of as illuminated manuscripts, and some of them were more like prayer books. So there's a whole variety there. Someone's job would have been to ready the parchment just by smoothing it out and chalking the surface of the parchment. So that was one job. Then another person would come along and rule the parchment, creating the lines. Then a third person would copy the text into the book, and yet another person would add the illuminations. So in particular, it's worth noting that the scribes and the illuminators for these manuscripts are likely different people. So the illuminator is adding in around what the scribe has already offered. So just a nice interplay of these different specialties, that someone's specialty would have been writing those letters really perfectly, and someone's specialty would have been in the larger art pieces that are in these illuminations. This started among monks, but there is some evidence over time that lay people got involved in the creation of these illuminated manuscripts, and there's also evidence of women being involved during the medieval period in creating illuminated manuscripts, particularly as the scribes. That's noted that the women who were involved were likely scribes, not any of the other jobs, for what it's worth. So the first that we'll look at is the Psalter of St. Columba, which makes sense for us to look at, of course. So this book was written around 600, and it was likely copied from a book owned by St. Finian, and was likely made by Columba himself. So one of the early copyright issues that there is record of is related to the Psalter that St. Columba copied, that he was training under Finian, legend goes. He was training under Finian, saw this Psalter that was particularly beautiful, and wanted to copy it so that he could carry it with him wherever he went. Finian did not like that, and felt that Columba had stolen something from him by copying this manuscript, which then led to a battle and eventually to St. Columba's expulsion from Ireland, which is how he ended up with an abbey on Iona in Scotland. The way that the story goes is that Columba was instructed to go far enough away that he couldn't see Ireland, which, you know, depending on fog any given day, maybe far, maybe not that far. But this is one of the oldest surviving manuscripts from Ireland. It still has some significant damage around the edges, but is largely intact. And for anyone who feels curious about this, you can... you can view these in detail online. So there's a few websites that have these old manuscripts, and you can go page by page in some real detail if you're curious about the writing. So there we can see some of those intricate capitals that were part of this tradition. But people have gone about scanning these all in to make them accessible for people like us that wouldn't, most of us would not have reason to go to one of these libraries and get permission to look at the original. Maybe you have some credentials that I don't know about, in which case let's talk because I think it's really cool. But for those of us average people, if we're curious about it, a lot of it's available online. Really detailed scans, really well done work that helps us to have access. So, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Psalms. So it's not anything that Finian himself wrote, but the original book that Finian bought would have likely been really, really expensive. So that's, I think, part of it is the cost related to it, that Finian paid a tremendous amount of money for the Psalter. And Columba paid a lot in terms of his labor to copy it, that he was, as the story goes, overnight going and looking at Finian's Psalter and copying it as well as he could in that like dusk time when there was just enough light. So it's not intellectual property or plagiarism as we would think of it. So it's not truly a copyright issue in the sense that we think of it today, but it's an early evidence of those sorts of questions of what are we allowed to copy and then call our own? How does that work? So sort of an interesting debate there. This Psalter would have been written, or is written, on vellum, which was dry lined for 25 lines per page. And this image, these are centimeters on the side, if you want to take a look at how that's lined. So about a centimeter per line, a little less. So someone, as we talked about, would have gone through and created those lines, and then someone else would come through and write over them. Of this book, about 58 of the folios have survived out of 110. So about half is still remaining. And as we saw in the previous image, a lot is missing right around the edges. But for its age, pretty well intact. The text of the Psalms and the rubrics related to them would have been written by the same scribe. So that's not a place where that division of labor would have come in. So the red text at the top, we can assume, is a rubric related to the Psalm. The next one we'll look at is the Book of Duro, which was written somewhere between 650 and 700. And it's the oldest insular illuminated gospel book that we have record of. And here, insular refers to a kind of script. It's a form of medieval script that spread from Ireland to England and then throughout the European continent, mostly through missionary efforts. And the word insular here comes from many of these being island communities, and particularly abbeys on those islands who are using this form of writing. So it has insular script, or insular art has some particular features that are notable. One of those is these large first letters of a paragraph or chapter. This would be the start of a chapter. I think it's the start of the Book of Mark. So that really bold letter starting it off, just the start of a paragraph, would of course be smaller. But these large first letters, often embellished with red dots, and they have a gradual decrease in the size of the letters from that first letter down to the rest of the writing. And this is called the diminuendo effect, and it's distinctive of this style. And is not, it later gets picked up by some other writing traditions. But here, like, we can see the first word starts really large and it gradually drops down until it's the normal size. Sort of interesting. And then another distinctive feature relates to the letters. The letters with ascenders, so B, D, H, letters that have that stem on the side, would always be depicted with a triangular or wedge-shaped top. So that's another distinctive feature of these letters. The Book of Duro was likely created for missionary and teaching purposes. And one of the things about it that has given its fame is that there are six carpet pages. And I'll show some of those. But pages that the whole thing is an illustration. Likely borrowing from the tradition of Persian rugs. So people who would have had some exposure to that form of artistry and using it in a different way. So this book has six carpet pages, and there's ornamentation at the start of each gospel. So like I said, this is one of those pages. For anyone who's particularly curious about writing styles as they evolve across time, I'm not going to stay on this for too long because I'm far from expert in any of this, but I thought it was kind of interesting to look at the ways that different forms of writing inform one another. And again, we're looking at that, the insular script. These books, some of them would be, well, most of them I think are in Latin. Is the assumption that I think we can make about most of them, yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Mary Beth.
I was gonna ask you if that large first letter which we see chosen sometimes in, you know, current works.
Mm-hmm.
That started there? That was the origin of that, do you think?
Yeah, this is the first place that we see it gaining real prominence is in these insular scripts. So when we see it later, it's likely inspired by this. And that's part of, so I named it, started in Ireland, then went to England, and then beyond into the European continent. So this was a form of writing that was, the writing itself was shared for the efforts of missionary work and teaching, but the style, of course, spreads along with the content of the writing, so that it spreads in that way. So these are a couple of the carpet pages from the Book of Duro. And this book has just a few primary colors that are used. We'll look at the Book of Kells in a moment, which has a lot of colors and is probably the most famous of these illuminated manuscripts. But in this book, we see red, yellow, and green as the primary colors that the artist used. And again, these are scans that historians have put up available online, if you're curious. One of the things that I find interesting in looking at these is that you can see where these pages have been repaired and stitched back together. So the stitches that we can see on the left panel in particular, those wouldn't have been there, but are just to show us the way that time has passed. Since the creation of these manuscripts. And for me, shows the love that his art historians have put into the preservation of these. There's another carpet page more zoomed in. And we can see some of those Celtic symbols that we were looking at the start. So we can see the three swirls together. Those are not connected in the same way that the one we were looking at earlier was. We can see knots on the side of different kinds. So a lot of those symbols coming into the way that scripts are being illuminated. Here's another carpet page. This one includes animals and snakes that would have been part of the Anglo-Saxon tradition. And then again, we can see like a Celtic cross in the center. More of these knots. Lots of places where three of something are used. And this is zooming in on those snakes that are at the bottom and top of the page.
Wait, why are there snakes? Didn't somebody chase the snakes out of Ireland?
Yes. Yeah, I think some of this is just is borrowing from the art tradition at the time, yeah. These are just another couple of detail shots here. So this is an eagle on the left side where we can clearly see that the artist used a compass to create these shapes, some real intricate details there. And then the piece on the right is where someone has gone in and offered corrections or notes in the margin over the course of time. I'm a person who writes in my books always, so I like seeing historic marginalia in this way, but likely someone going in and adding some words that were left out and copying it. So it's more than likely a correction there. And especially because these manuscripts were so laborious to create. If you had just a few words missing, you were squeezing it into the margin, not remaking that whole page. So there are many of these manuscripts where you can find little bits like that. We are all only human. Spend a couple minutes looking at the Book of Kells. So like I said, this is the one that has a lot of fame around it. Written around 800. And it is really an unrivaled manuscript in its kind, in the scale, in the detail, in the artistry, and in the cultural significance of this particular document. There are full-page illustrations throughout the book. Those are illustrations of Christ, different stories related to Christ. There are illustrations of each of the gospelers, and there are also lots of tables of information that are throughout the book, and I'll show you one of those that's pretty interesting. This is another place where we can see in detail some of these pages. So when we zoom in on this one, we can see those knots, the Trinity. There's some people inside of this letter. So there's all sorts of little details that you could spend time exploring. And the Book of Kells, the whole thing is available online through Trinity College in Dublin. So if you're curious, it's a lot of fun to look through. And you can see in these, some of it's abstract, some of it's use of those Celtic symbols, geometric illustrations, or representational art. And this image, I should have started by saying this, this is the Cairo that's at the start of the Gospel of Matthew in the Book of Kells, and Cairo is the Greek initials for Jesus. So here's one of those tables. This is right at the start of the book, so it's likely a table of contents or something to that effect. And again, we can see the ways that there's the larger shapes that are each filled with these intricate details. So this is where it's really fun to use the work of those historians who scanned each of these pages in, where you can look at these in real detail. A couple more tables. So the one that's on the left is the genealogy of Jesus. And that's right at the start of the Gospel of Luke. I like that there's a person sitting near the bottom of the genealogy. I'm not entirely sure who that is, but I think it's neat. Then the image on the right is a comparison of the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of John and the stories that are shared in each of those. And then down at the bottom is an Irish charter related to the monastery that was at Kells. So how the charter information ended up on this same page, I'm not totally sure, but I guess it was something they needed to keep track of, and there was some room at the bottom of the page. So that's sort of interesting, too, that some other stuff makes it into the Book of Kells. A couple more. These are pretty famous pages from the Book of Kells, so you maybe have seen these before. On the left, the Virgin Mary and child, angels surrounding them. Again, we see some of those Celtic images coming in. Lots of detail there. And then on the right, we have the images of the gospelers. The Book of Kells uses a different depiction of the gospelers than is used elsewhere, so it's unique here. We have Matthew as a man, Mark as a lion, Luke as a calf, and John as an eagle, whereas in other places, we see Mark as an eagle and John as a lion. So the Book of Kells switches those depictions and is unique in that regard. That one of the gospelers is another that's really fun to look at in detail. Any thoughts or questions related to these pages from the Book of Kells or the other books?
This is likely a misunderstanding or a
I don't know, and so the question is about whether the switching of identities here was a purposeful choice or a misunderstanding. I don't know. Scholars who have looked at this just note that it is different, but don't go into a lot of detail as to why. I'm curious about that myself, but that's one of the things of it being from the 800s that is just sort of lost to history. Yeah. Yeah, Mary Beth?
Following up on that, the switching, were the original imagery of the animals, was that also originating from Celtic tradition?
It was not. So Saint Irenaeus is the person who identified these symbols for each of the gospelers. And it's of note, I think that the Book of Duros is the first place that those are illuminated in this way. So it's interesting that about 100 years later, the Book of Kells does something different. But St. Irenaeus is the person who sort of identified those symbols. Do you have another? Yeah. I am not able to zoom in this presentation and don't have an easy link to it. But if you send me an email, I'll be glad to direct you to where you can find that. Yeah, Joe.
I wasn't sure about the Book of Kells. I know that earlier you mentioned that these would be produced for one of the goals would be for missionaries today. Do you know if that's the case for this also?
Yeah, so the question is about these books being used for missionaries. Because of the intricacy of the Book of Kells, I think it is more likely that it was used for teaching purposes within a community. There are examples of these books being encased in these, I mean, like the book had its own suitcase made of wood to take them around because of their value. So it's possible that the Book of Kells traveled around a bit. But just the sheer amount of artistry involved in this makes it hard to think about it getting carted around all over the place. But I do think it was shared at least some in local missionary work, but likely would have been at Kells for most of its life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question is about the women involved in these texts, and were they lay women? Were they in convents? It's not totally clear who the women were. I think it's likely that they were vowed religious people, just because of the fact that most of the people who are working on these manuscripts are in religious community, and women would have been parts of those communities too. There are examples in Ireland and Scotland of co-ed monastic communities. So there might have been places where there were both men and women within the same community. And that is possibly why women got involved. There's not a whole lot of detail about who those people were, but it's something that sparks my curiosity too. I was going to have us do a bit of reflection on another image, but we're just after 11, so I'll just show it to you instead. This is an illustration of the temptation of Christ that we hear right at the beginning of Lent. So this is from the Gospel of Luke. We can see the devil over on the right side. I didn't do big work digging into all of the images here. But my guess is that Jesus here is depicted standing atop the temple when he's led up to the top of the temple, and the devil says, if you swear allegiance to me, all this will be yours. So that's my assumption about the specific vignette this is showing, but an interesting image with a lot of detail, a lot of little people all around. Thanks, y'all. It's fun to dig into.